Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Actors, in many ways, are on a course specifically, like almost perfectly designed to destroy the ego. That to keep sane and do well in this job, I think you have to transcend the ego.
Well, because the innate nature of the constant rejection.
The rejection, the scrutiny, and that ultimately it's never about you. It's never about who you are. The audience's interpretation of character it's got very little to do with who you might be. Like, I like to think I'm quite a nice person.
Welcome to A Lot to Learn with Austin Rogers. For the guy who knows everything, he's still got a lot to learn.
When I had set out to conduct this interview with up-and-coming British actor Chris Webster, I thought it would be the typical story of navigating LA, auditions, etc. Instead, what happened was a strange coincidence, a strange confluence of momentous events happening nearly simultaneously. You see, the day beforehand, Chris had a potentially pivotal career event happen to him. And the very morning before I interviewed Chris, a potentially life-changing career event happened to me, for I had just come from interviewing Mr. Alex Trebek at his home. So what follows is a conversation about two guys who just had something really big happen to them and trying to figure out what that means, where we came from, and where we're going. Enjoy this interview with actor Chris Webster. Welcome, 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 welcome. Good morning, good evening, good afternoon, good night. I have no idea what time it is because this is a podcast and we listen to podcasts whenever we might. Perhaps you are in an absolutely lovely Airbnb backyard little bungalow house in, I don't even know what neighborhood this is called of Los Angeles, but the sky is blue, the foliage is green, and the astroturf is spongy. And thus we are here with an excellent up-and-coming actor, Chris Webster. Chris, welcome.
Hello. Thank you very much for having me.
Oh my God, that was the most dulcet. This is, by the way, a very sexy gentleman with piercing blue eyes, amazing hair, and you heard the voice. Just say that one more time.
Hello. Thank you very much.
Way better. You may want to flash back to one of our prior episodes after this to hear a conversation I had with Chris's lovely wife, Dr. Lambine, on crazy dark stuff.
Yeah.
And that sort of touches on you too, on why you went into acting. You got a little bit of a dark side.
Well, to be honest, I mean, like, I started acting when I was about 7. So I don't think I had too much of a dark side, like when I was doing the Sorcerer's Apprentice. Can I swear?
You can swear. Right. I don't see why not.
No, I just wanted to set some ground rules.
Yeah, no, please. Yeah.
I'm not, okay, let's.
When you swear, it's in that accent, therefore it's charming. When I swear, it's gauche and it's just nasty.
Right, okay.
7 years old.
I was 7 years old. Yeah, yeah. Is this what I do? Do I tell you like why?
Yeah. Well, because everyone wants to know. Because we're going to talk later with Chris, and because he has had that pivotal moment that everyone hopes for in a creative career. But let's
potentially
get,
yeah.
Potentially. Well, let's get them there. So you weren't always the dark, brooding actor. You were a 7 year old boy.
I grew up in the British countryside. I was born in Luton, which is a horrible place in the southeast of England, but it just happened to be where I was incarnated in this particular life. I grew up in the British countryside, and I had an idyllic sort of childhood in many ways. It was a very beautiful part of the country, and I grew up in a lovely old house. And yeah, I remember the first role I had was as one of the three kings in the play. Originally, though, I was going to be an angel. And I, even when I was five, obviously the male ego had kicked in at that point, because I remember thinking, I'm a bloke. I had this idea that angels were all... Obviously, my biblical studies weren't sufficient to know that Gabriel and all those chaps are actually dudes.
Right.
In my head, I was like, I need to play something more macho than this. And I managed to bag... I think some kid that was sick was one of the Three Kings. And I was one of the Three Kings. I remember I walked in. I was so excited. I remember that particular day, all the kids lining up. I still remember it like it was yesterday. And... we're all in our costumes, and I just remember thinking the thought, and I'm not, this isn't hyperbole, it really is true. I just remember thinking, this is
what
it's all about.
Yeah.
That's what it's all about, man. Like the pageantry, the ritual of it, how pointless it was. Do you know what I mean? But suddenly it was everything. And I got a little costume, and it was the 80s or the early 90s, so it wasn't politically correct. So I think somebody put a tea towel over my head, so I looked like I was, vaguely Arab.
Oh, my God.
We did that sort of stuff back then. And I remember I had a pillow, and I had a tin, which had the frankincense. I was supposed to have the frankincense in. And I walked in, and the first thing I did was drop it. tin light was banging around, and I just burst into tears. That's my first experience on the stage.
So the first role, that was a critical bust. but the magic and the pageantry and that sort of thing stuck with you.
Totally. It still does.
Well, I can't imagine that it wouldn't, because this... actor life, there's hashtags, and there's actor life hashtags, and there's so many programs on even stand-up comedy or musicians or actors that breaking through, but that daily grind for year upon year upon year, when it just all looks dark forever and ever, yet you keep doing it. Now, some people keep doing it, and it becomes this, sad spectacle where it's like, you should have gone, just stick with waiting now. Just stick with being the waiter.
We live in a town full of
that, who have overstayed their welcome, and it's sad, because they're always like, Bryan Cranston got his first big role at age 41. Mm. Okay, yeah, but maybe it could have gone to someone else if Bryan Cranston had given up. Oh, but don't give up, but give up, but don't give up. What's this so-called hashtag actor life like?
I think it's different for everybody. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that, not just in a kind of existential sort of life is experientially kind of different for every single human being, but everybody, there's no single route into this industry. So let me give you a few examples.
Please.
Set routes in. So from a British perspective, there's actually one route in, which is kind of formalized now. The typical route in is you go to one of a handful of accredited drama schools, and you get plucked from a graduating class of one of those, usually quite early on, so age 21 or so, maybe even maybe a few years older, 23, 24, and from that drama school you get access to very good representation, and there's what I call the kind of the slipstream, the quick stream, the higher tier, basically the kind of fast road in.
Right.
And so they're the young people that you're starting to see sort of regularly kind of show up in BBC dramas and in films and at the National Theatre and that sort of stuff. And that's when I say that's become kind of formalised in Britain, what I mean by that is I think there was a time prior to my era in the 70s, 60s, 70s and 80s, because I've met actors that are now in their sort of 60s and 70s and worked with them from the UK who didn't train conventionally and didn't go to drama school. And there was a flourishing kind of subsidised theatre movement at that time in Britain, where you could basically like work your way up. You could work your way up in the ranks, and you'd get your equity card, and you could work steadily. So this whole kind of culture of like the gigging economy of like you have to wait tables in the meantime. In Britain, there was a seemingly a kind of a golden age where, in actual fact, you could be with your mates and with little theatre companies earning a kind of relatively modest living, doing what you wanted to do, doing what you loved. And that's largely gone in England. So I'm not saying you have to go to drama school to be like a working actor in Britain, but my experience and the reason why I'm sitting here in Los Angeles before you is that because I didn't go to drama school, I went to university, I was sort of raised very middle class to sort of believe, and my father was like very much like, you need to go and get a degree in something else, a fallback thing. Which I understand why he did that, but and why that was the kind of pressure that was put on me. But I can talk about that at some other point. But so I didn't go to drama school, and I just thought, well, hey, I want to do this. I'm good at it now. I've done a bunch of commercials by that point, and a bunch of plays. I trained in Shakespeare and other sort of classical theatre. I'm ready to do this now. There must be a way to sort of make this viable.
Bypassing the jet stream because exactly. You did not go into
correct. So,
but you still got some guns behind you got some parts under your belt.
Correct. And I worked when I was in Britain, but by basically going to source and writing to agents and just being like, hey, these are my credentials. This is what I've done. These are the companies that I've been involved with. Like, I'd really like to get an opportunity. I found it very, very difficult to get. I had a couple of really, really wonderful people that repped me and punched above their weight, but it was very, very difficult to get sort of into bigger rooms and into rooms basically which I could earn a living from. Mm-hmm. So ultimately, that was one of the contributing reasons why I came to LA. So that's my particular kind of route into what you were asking about. In this country and the kind of people you were referring to, there's way more of a... the insidious thing about Los Angeles, and I think about acting in this city in general, is that those stories are true. Like, there are people, hell man, I did it. Like, I got my green card, I set up in Virginia for a couple months to sort my paperwork out, and then my wife and I piled our car up, our 2002 Solara, with belongings, and we drove it across the country, and we showed up, and we didn't know anybody. Mm-hmm. And within 3 weeks. Okay, now I'd been a working actor in Britain, but within 3 weeks I had a tier of management and people repping me and believing me, which I had never had access to in the UK.
Right.
And, you know, I'd tested for a pilot within 4 months, maybe even less. I booked my first job within, 18 months, and it was a decent series regular job on AMC, and it was with Jamie Bell, who's a wonderful actor.
Oh, I love Jamie Bell.
Great, he's a great man.
Yeah.
And he's really, really nice dude.
Did not know he was English until I saw behind the scenes on Battlestar.
Yeah, and he's from the Northeast.
I know, right? So I'm like Captain Lee Adama. Yeah. You know, I'm like, you're the coolest guy on earth.
Yeah. So what I'm trying to say is that because LA seemingly is more of an open market than, for instance, London, which is a very kind of a place of pedigree and training. Mm-hmm. It's a clothes shop and it's a small industry. LA's massive, and right now, like the amount of content that you have going on, these rags to riches stories are technically possible.
But like you said, insidious in that the dreams dangled on
the
there
sell.
That anyone can do it.
That's the sell.
Come here.
That's the sell.
Make the new life.
That's why every Uber driver, you know, and every waiter, you know, like, you know, fucking everybody in this town is in some way, if they're not trying to be an actor, then they're some way trying to be a creative within the entertainment industry.
Right. And then, you know, you got the classic scenes, and it's played over and over again in movies and media ad nauseum. The waiter goes, and by the way, Mr. De Niro, hey, just take a look at this spec script I wrote for you.
And I could
imagine having like infinite modicum of celebrity achieved myself, right? I could imagine like when someone comes up to me, they don't, but if someone came up to me and be like, hey, read the script, mm-hmm. I'd probably be like, yeah, I will.
Right.
And then on the third one, I'd be like, I'll skim it.
Right.
And on the 45th one, I'd be like, no, I don't care. Yeah. I literally don't care.
And when perhaps one in every 400 is actually legible. Do you know what I mean?
Like, right.
I'm exaggerating, of course, but like you do. So a big part of living here and being a part of that community is sort of filtering out the nutters. You want to attract the, you know, and it bums me out that I work in, you know, in an industry where there is a very high propensity of people who are just a bit detached from reality, you know? And so you find your people and you find your fellow creatives because it's important to surround yourself with good people, but also with kind of quality and people you want to work with. And you do, you know, even now I get worried sometimes when someone's like, hey, I've written this, will you read it? And the first thing I think is like, oh my God, what am I going to say if it's terrible? Do you know what I mean? like, you know, when they like, so do you have any notes for me?
Right, right. Because everyone's got an angle or a pitch.
The first thing I always say usually is when I get a script by a friend is if it's decent, the first thing I'll say is like, oh my God, it's thank you. Like, it's such a relief.
that you gave me a good one.
So I feel like that was a very rambling response to what you are, because I feel like what you're asking is like, why are people still showing up?
Is that the exact question?
I feel like that should be the crux of what we talk about, because that's something for me. I think it's important. Self-awareness in everything in your life is so important, and so I think
when you know, because there's ego. And yes, then there's self-awareness. And there is the point where you're like, I feel that I'm on the cusp of greatness.
What does greatness mean?
Right? Because you can't actually wrap your head around that, where you're like, the big thing is about to happen. And I know it because I've worked so hard. And the big thing just has to happen because I've worked so hard for it. But life isn't fair.
And also life doesn't work like that. Like I feel like we, you know, the unhealthiness of that thought process is always this idea that you're missing something and you just need that one big job, that one big role that's suddenly going to complete you and make, you know, your life, you know, make sense. And listen, I'm not taking away from the fact, like, I've been in positions of financial kind of like insecurity because of what I've chosen to do. So there is a financial life mental health component to that of like, not only will an opportunity in this field creatively fulfill me potentially, and you know, but also, you know, it's going to pay my health insurance, you know?
Yeah, right.
It's going to give me health insurance, you know, so that is a big part of it. But I feel like in answer to your question of what are people chasing, the cynical part of me wants to say I don't think they know. And in recent years, because of real shit that's happened in my life, I know I have become a much better actor as a consequence of it not being my career and my desire to be in this industry not being a product of my desire for ego validation of love me, accept me, aren't I brilliant, and more an understanding that life is short and that to do something creative and something that you love and something that is collaborative is a more rewarding way to earn a living and be free, essentially, than it is to slave away at something that you don't care about for the prospect of some illusory kind of security.
Right, because the act of the creation, the act of the acting, is to you more fulfilling.
But you must relate to that because, I mean, your life path has been like when was the last time you punched a clock, you know,
I'm not slagging it off.
Some people, like my cousin, I love the guy, he punches a clock, he's an attorney, he hates what he does, publicly says how much he hates what he does, but it allows him to sort of like, you know, like go on vacation whenever he wants, or, you know.
Well, I can reflect on that, and actually we're sort of the same ilk in that we don't quite, I never said when's the next big thing? You know, when I worked in events planning, I did that for 10 years, and I'm like, I hate this, and I always wanted to be creative. Then I got an advertising job, and I really liked it. But advertising is a fickle mistress, and I got laid off, and I got a severance. And so I thought, I got this great events background, being creative and creating corporate events and being awesome with clients and also sort of type A and type B combined. Then I got this awesome creative experience at the ad agency. I'm like, my resume is fucking dope now. So now I'm going to get that really big creative job. I'm going to be like, you know, an executive copywriter or something like that. I'm going to write the cool ads for the cool stuff, and it's going to be super cool. And a month goes by, and 3 months go by, and a year goes by, and a year and a half goes by, and I'm getting fourth and fifth round interviews, and I think there's something. I'm like, I'm on the cusp of greatness. There it is again. Right. And my severance dwindles, and then I start going to my savings, and my savings dwindle, yeah. And then I start going to my retirement fund, and that dwindles. And now I'm like, there is no cusp of greatness. Yeah. I've applied to 9,822 jobs and had fifth round interviews in 7,000 of them, right? And then my friends just said, do you want to bartend at our bar that you've been going to? And I go, yes, of course. And then my click went off. Like, then I saw the spectacle. I'm like, and all the fanfare, because I'm like, I should have been bartending my entire life. I should have been standing behind a bar, chatting with friends and making fun of people and serving drinks and sleeping at weird hours and waking up at weird hours. So I hit my pinnacle. My next great thing was actually my fallback plan. And then I've been happy ever since. Then I went on Jeopardy and I made $100,000 or whatever. And then everything really changed. But now I know that I don't have to aspire towards that next big thing, because the big thing was secondary to the thing that made me happy, which was being behind the bar in the first place. If I never went on Jeopardy and was still behind the bar right now with no podcast and no book deal and no nothing, I'd be freaking happy, because I'd be behind the bar and happy.
Maybe it's an irrelevant question, but the thing that springs to my mind is, had you not said yes to the bar job from your friend, do you think you would have had the courage, freedom, wherewithal, balls to put yourself forward for Jeopardy? And I don't know, like is that something that you would have done? Like, was
that was something I was constantly doing. I was always taking I always took the online test. I took it 10, 11 times or something like that. That was just a, again, that was a casual thing. That was like, hey, I'm pretty good at trivia, I'll just do this. I still would have, even if I was still unemployed, I would still have found a way to take that online test and then hopefully get the in-person audition. Because I actually had an in-person Jeopardy audition 9 years prior to me being on the show. So there was like a 9-year gap between me actually getting one of the in-person auditions. You take an online test, then you get an in-person audition, then you either get a phone call or you don't. I took the online test, got the in-person audition, and then that was the end of it. And 9 years later, I took the test, got the audition, got the phone call, come to LA. So that was always there, but it was never, there are people out there, and trust me, I know them, who are like, this is my hunger, my dream, my life, my goal. That's their next big thing, to be on Jeopardy. For me, it was like, hey, there's a fun thing to do.
Right.
Yeah. So in a way, I'm sort of a dick, because like, like, I got people's amazing lifelong dream, not by dumb luck, obviously by talent, but yeah, because it was a casual thing. I'll just take the online test, right?
Like the life's full of, I mean, like my day job that I do to stop myself from going mad and also just secure like a regular income is I'm actually an editor of a newspaper back in the UK, a trade magazine, and I have been for about 3 or 4 years now. And journalism's really hard to get into.
Journalism is impossible to get into.
Super hard to get into. And so, yeah, I've been in that situation before where I'm at like conferences and stuff, and just by sheer accident, I'm sitting next to somebody who's worked their ass off to get there. And I've just kind of, you know, I'm just punching the clock just to sort of, you know, earn the paycheck.
Yeah, it's not like I feel like a shitty person for it, but I do feel a little bit of guilt when it's like, that's someone's aspirational dream that I just sort of tripped and fell into. And not only that, but tripped and fell and excelled at it. Yeah. I'm not saying I didn't work hard. I studied my ass off, but it came a lot easier to me than to others.
But that brings me on to this kind of like I sometimes think that the the old cliche of like it's the journey getting somewhere which is actually the kind of the reward in itself, the striving. It's really interesting, man. Because I've been through years and years since I've been to Los Angeles of just kind of like the trenches, the slog of just auditions, and it's been an odd kind of step change in phase in my life, because I went from being in London and having a couple of auditions every few months if I was lucky. And some years where I maybe went out like for maybe three or four different things, like paid roles, maybe even less, to being in Los Angeles, and all of a sudden it's like, wow, okay, we're taking this person relatively seriously, and I'm going out like dozens of times in a month, and then sometimes periods where it's even busier than that, and then sometimes periods where it's a little slower, and then now I've reached a point in recent weeks where there's been a big job that's landed for me, and I was just flown out to Toronto, business class, and for a day for a table read with these wonderful, wonderful actors that I really, really respect.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years, like a chatbot maybe your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And what am I trying to say? Theoretically, in this kind of culture which we have, which is it's all about this goal, it's this dream of achieving something, you would assume that everybody that's at that top tier that has achieved it should be incredibly happy and
completely complacent. Yeah.
Then why, I think it's an interesting phenomenon that we propagate this idea, and yet the people who are seemingly like the wealthiest and most successful in their field, certainly within entertainment, tend to be, publicly at least, sort of not the happiest and not the. I've been thinking a lot about that, just because creatively right now, I'm just in such a fortunate place and such a fortunate position. And for me, I think a big part of staying present and happy is just remembering being grateful and remembering each phase of how I got there. That's something I really don't want to lose.
I really appreciate how thoughtful you are about this whole process, and how
I think it's selfish though, man, because it is, because it's about my own joy. Do you know what I mean? It's about my own joy. So in a way it's like, yeah, cool. Like I can sound like a bit hippie about it and be like, oh yeah, I want to stay grounded.
But it's still about you.
Not losing the novelty of how wonderful an opportunity like that is. Yeah, I think that's very easy to do. That's something that I'm cognizant of in myself.
I think it's incredibly. I feel privileged and special being in your presence right now, because you can impart onto the listener who might be an aspiring creative. You are at this bizarre nexus of the universe where time space has stopped for you, because there potentially there is a pre Chris Webster and there is a potentially a post Chris Webster at the moment that we sit right here, due to this amazing opportunity that you've just potentially, knock on wood, embarked upon. Can you see the forest from the trees at this point and see, like,
yeah totally. Yeah. I mean, like, it's, you know, like, I don't know. Like, yeah, I've landed a great role. It's really good for me, and it's with some wonderful, really good people, really good actors, and good human beings. And I'm just so stoked to be a part of it. That, you know, that said, you know, I don't know how it's going to be received. I don't know how I'm going to be received. You know, it's all up in the air. So it's just, I think what I was trying to get at just now was just like, for now, I don't want to be thinking about, like, what's post Chris Webster. Do you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
like, that's not relevant. Like for me, what's relevant is, like, you know, who is Chris Webster right in this moment now, and how do I have the best time possible, and how do I conduct myself in the best manner?
Yeah, so you're not thinking like, yep, there we are, marquee, and I get a Marvel pick.
Well, of course. I mean, like, of course I fucking am. Of course I fucking am. But I don't like that part of me. That's what I'm saying. You know, like, I don't like that part of me. Like, and whenever it shows up, there's just this, like, tired old man voice in me that goes, Chris, like,
shut up,
man. Like, it's not about that. And so for me, being an actor, I have this theory, Austin, that, you know, because we get this bad rep of, like, we're all these awful, like, egotists and stuff. And of course we are. Like, of course, like, you know, you don't get into this career if you're not somebody who at some point...
Yeah, you don't run for president. You don't run for president unless you've got, like, some chip on your shoulder.
Barack Obama.
Yeah, but he clearly has a fucking ego. Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, so there's an old adage that you never find an actor with a happy childhood. There's this idea that, you know, like, you're always out there for that, like, oh, love me, you know, like, validate me. That said, I have a loftier theory about this, right? And I think that if you indulge me for a second, and just kind of believe that, I don't know, we are all on some sort of a path of sorts, whether that be scientific, materialistic, or, you know, spiritual or whatever. I think that actors, in many ways, are on a course specifically, like, almost perfectly designed to destroy the ego. That to keep sane and do well in this job, I think you have to transcend the ego.
Well, because the innate nature of the constant rejection.
The rejection, the scrutiny, and that ultimately it's never about you. It's never about who you are. It's the audience's interpretation of character it's got very little to do with who you might be. Like, I like to think I'm quite a nice person, but I get cast often as very intense, terrible people because I have an intensity to,
yes, me. Yeah.
And a directness, I think, and a Germanic kind of face, which doesn't help. I don't know. So I think Los Angeles, in many ways, right now, is this kind of, like, perfect wrecking ball, the anvil upon which the human ego can be fucking, like, hammered out.
Right.
Because certainly that's been my case. I know I'm a better person now as a consequence of 3 years, 4 years of sort of solid going out, and no, not this time, not you, you know, and just getting over that.
Yeah, like, but yet balancing it with the still like, I'm pretty hot shit. I'm pretty hot shit. Okay, that guy doesn't think so, but he's just dumb. Yeah. Or like, they just don't get it. They don't get my art.
Is this conversation going where you wanted it to?
It's going in a better it's going in a way different place because you're way more thoughtful and introspective than the I just keep harping on Hollywood tropes. I'm a New Yorker. I don't really do the acting thing. I got a couple friends who are actors, yeah, and they're on TV and stuff like that, and they're just like, hey, where we at? We act on TV. It's our day job, right?
Right.
And it's refreshing to see someone who's like, oh, no, it's this anvil upon which you are hammered. yes, I want a Marvel movie.
Yeah, exactly.
Who's your favorite? Oh, but does Hollywood have enough room for yet another buff, attractive Chris with a cool accent? Because what do we got? We got the Pratt, we got the Hemsworth, we got the Pine, we got the...
They're all Chris, yeah.
Yeah.
I should change my name.
Yeah, Pratt, Hemsworth, Pine. There might be one more. Oh, Chris Tucker, of course, yeah. Because you totally look like Chris Tucker.
Yeah, totally.
Well, let's capture the lightning in the bottle of that phone call that you get.
Mm.
And this for everyone in like, because this goes for pretty much anything. When rejection, everyone deals with rejection, and then small victory, and then the potentiality of what just occurred, this big victory.
Right.
What's that punch in the gut when they're like, yeah, we do want to see you come to Toronto in a week?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Is it pinch me?
It's relief.
Ah.
For me, it was relief.
Oh, curious. How so?
Man, you know, like you get you question yourself. Of course you do. You would be mad to. Like, you know, it's 2019, like right now, like, you know, it's a tough time. I feel like kind of like I don't know, like my dad like earned a steady salary, a decent salary, you know, like and like you know, like that's what work was, that's what career was. So for me to I brought my wife here, you know, I brought Mackenzie, and now you've spoken to Mackenzie's doing fantastically,
yeah,
and is a fantastic human being. I would do fantastically were I not in the picture. The reason that we're here initially, at least, was because of me. And it's, you know, an expensive place to live, and it's a difficult place to live, and we're here because of my career. And so there's a great deal of responsibility, I feel, for that.
Well, there's another. You're dragging another person around.
I want to have a kid. Yeah. I want to own a house, and like, you know, there are these things that, you know, you risk a lot. You risk a lot, and you fear you don't want to be that person who's the wrong side of whatever age waiting tables, that people sort of don't say it to their face, but quietly, like, you know, and you know, as they walk away, like, say, oh gosh, it's sad, isn't it? Like,
yeah,
you don't want to be that person. And you really do. I do, you know, like I have worried at points that might be my fate. And my manager, you know, he's a guy called Brady, and he's one of the kindest, best human beings that I've met, and I came to the city never thinking in a million years I'd land with somebody like him. You know, the cliche of the kind of Hollywood trope is that, you know, it's a snake pit. Well, he isn't like that at all. And I once called him, and, you know, you can tell it upsets me, or like, you know, it's difficult, it's frightening for me. And I called him up once, sort of in floods of tears, and I was just like, I'm so sorry, I just feel like I'm letting you down, like, I feel like I should have booked by now, I need to earn you some money, and I'm frightened that I'm going to die, like, before I get to fulfill this potential of mine. And he said to me, your potential, Chris, is, first of all, he's like, you could die at any point. your potential is what your wife thinks of you, and who your friends are, and your regard within that community and the people that love you. I've got plenty of money, don't fucking worry about me. And so So I remember the relief I felt after that phone call with him, and I've never told him actually how much that meant to me, but the relief I felt then was similar to when that I got the phone call, funnily enough, from him and my agent Lindsay, who's a very good friend of his and is a very lovely woman, saying, hey, yeah, you know, you got this. Shock, surreal, but the biggest emotion was relief and vindication of sorts.
That's the ego again. Yeah. You're like, yeah, they were all wrong, you'll see now, but not in like a malicious way, but more like in a fulfillment way.
Yeah.
And then how long does that take to wear off to your like, oh shit, now I gotta learn the lines and go to the table read.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, like, it never stops because, yeah, because then
you have another panic moment.
Anxiety isn't, oh, they're not gonna pick me. Or,
now it's oh my god, I'm sitting in a room with A and B and C and X and Y, and it's directed by Z. And I've, oh god, oh god, did I actually want this in the first place?
So I heard that voice yesterday at the table,
right,
in my head, and I just did away with it. I was like, man, this might be it. This might be the only opportunity I get, uh-huh. You know? So like, I'm just going to have a blast. And I had a lot of fun, and it was really nice because a couple of people came up to me afterwards and said, I could tell that you really enjoyed doing that.
I'm just operating in these tropes and cliches, because if there's one thing LA media likes to do, it's to portray itself in LA media, right? So I
you never get more billboards anywhere else about shows than in Los Angeles. It's just because it's like, hey, look what we're doing.
Yeah. Oh my god, look. Fosse Verdon, Golden Globes, whatever. But you got that picture of the table read, and you know, it's the actors are sitting around with their name cards and their bottles of water,
yeah,
and then the writers and the producers and the director's at the table, and everyone else is sitting around, and all the assistants are sitting around in the background with like their notepads, and yeah. And is that real?
Yeah, it's all real.
That's really how it happens.
I've never been to one until yesterday.
Oh, okay, cool. You were excited too. You're like, oh shit, that room actually looks like that room.
it's surreal.
Hey, okay, now here's something really interesting that I never really thought about. In essence, by consuming media, you are hardwired to these cultural, social cues and norms that will occur should you reach each subsequent phase of the acting career, because you're already acclimatized to being
meta way. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's very meta, because you're acclimatized to being the clumsy waiter who just really wants to act, because I'm actually a clumsy waiter who really wants to act, and you see that on, and then you get the table read and you're, you know, the up and coming star, and you get to sit down next to, in the movie it's called Mr. Smitherson, but clearly that's supposed to be, you know, De Niro in the movie, and like, Mr. Smitherson, I loved your work, and he brushes you off, and you're like, oh well, no, I'm just gonna go and I'm just gonna slay this line, I'm gonna kill this line, do it, right? So in essence,
you're literally describing what happened.
Yes. Well, I'm just saying, we're all, I guess, wow, which came first? Are we prepped for those tropes because we've seen them so many times, or do people just naturally reinforce?
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's because that's the thing. I think we're at a point, you know, within our culture now, where that's probably happening, where it's becoming a self-fulfilling prophecy.
You will behave in that situation because you've seen how it has been portrayed as behavior, where you're in there and you're like, you know, what is it, some at the end everyone says basically the same euphemisms with different vocabulary, like, I just found it so scintillating. Oh, you found it scintillating? I found it spectacular. You found it, you know? Excellent job. Great job, everyone. Great job. That's a wrap. Did that stuff happen?
It wasn't quite as entourage.
Okay.
It was, I'm working on a project which, you know, there's a lot of money at stake.
Mm-hmm.
So, it becomes this strange amalgamation of, I think that's one thing. That's a big difference, and perhaps something may be of interest to you, is that, like, to go from like passion projects that you do with your friends, short films and that sort of stuff, or even like an independent movie or a play somewhere quite respected, to a big budget production, you know, television, film production, it's art meets kind of corporate funding, you know, there's a formality to it which doesn't exist in other.
When you're throwing together your student film in a backyard,
right? And maybe there's a casting director that comes to your play or something like that, and you want to be like, oh, so and so's here, and she cast so and so. Becky, I'm so, you know, so pleased that you came. Thank you so much. Oh, that's very kind of you to say. It was good. You know, like there's a formality there. But when you're sitting, you know, in a room with numerous people, which, you know, I don't know, if you want to get like, if you listen to the kind of career brain, it's like, oh, wow, this person could really pop my career. Or maybe they could have a word with so-and-so. Like, you know, there's a lot more seemingly at stake. And it's just, it's a more formal, business-like environment, which is something that, as I say, was my first table read yesterday. I wasn't entirely prepared for, but rolled with it. The way I saw it was like, hey, you know, I've been taken on to play X role, you know, and so I'm gonna read that to the best of my ability. That's my job in this room. And just do that and be nice to everybody. Just be friendly and say, thanks, I'm really happy to be here.
I guess to have that seat at the table, there has to be some level of gratitude. Why are all of your people taking our people's jobs? why is it like, you know, you'll be watching I'm saying that snidely, but I actually do mean it. Is there something in the work ethic or something? Because like, I'm like, yeah, I love that guy. And then he opens his mouth. I'm like,
he's British.
The fuck? He's British?
Yeah.
Wait,
he
was playing a Southern gangster. How the hell did he? Why couldn't they find a Southern gangster a Southern guy to play that? Yeah. Wait, okay. What's your theory on it? Why? And by your people, I mean Australians also.
Yeah. What do you mean, you people? I think the key distinction is in the States, you guys believe, presiding theory that acting is just art. It's an innate art, and you can wing it, and there's something unique about who you are as a person that Joe Bloggs from the street can just walk in and just like book that series leading role. But in actual fact, in Britain, there's we have a great heritage of theatre, and theatre is incredibly technical. Filmmaking is actually incredibly technical. I mean, the amount of times like you can be the next James Dean, and how kind of like, you know, you're tearing me apart. you can get all that internal struggle and be as method as you like, but if you're not hitting your fucking cue, no one's going to see you. You know, like so there are technicalities that they're both very technical mediums, and my suspicion is that one of the things that American producers, directors, casting directors like is that, what's a number of things, we show up on time more often, I think, because we're way more grateful to be there, because we're used to paying for our own rail fare when you book a BBC drama, which is actually something that happens.
Could be on Downton Abbey.
No frills. Yeah,
you could be on Downton Abbey, and it's like, I'll see you there next week, and you're like, how? They're like, I don't know, get there.
Get down here. Yeah, that's really happened. So you expect less, and expect less glamour, but also we have a legacy of training, and so it's about, you know, it's just daft things like projection and clarity and discipline of like training, you know, accents, dialects, that sort of stuff. I mean, also there's things that Americans can't help, that such as like, you know, hey, it's not your fault that you're culture has been dominant for the past 100 years, so we tend to be able to do your accent quite well because we grew up listening to all your movies and all that sort of stuff. Whereas Britain, I mean, like, good luck trying to do a convincing British accent, because we have a different accent for every single town.
Exactly.
And like, I mean, as Maria will tell you, like, you know, Britain and, you know, Anglophile, Britain kind of cultures, Britain-based cultures or former colonies, whatever, you can... You can't just tell where someone's from. I mean, you can tell how much money they have. Like, it's weird.
Yeah.
The caste system.
Oh yeah.
And so it's very difficult to as an outsider to replicate that. And also the dumbest reason as well, which is just you lot think that our accents are nice and that because you used to be a colony. And I think there's some sort of weird kind of kind of, still the boss.
It's kind of weird fetishization, weird,
like, Stockholm syndrome,
like half submissive, half dominant. It's like, oh, spank me, daddy. But also at the same time, we won. But I just sort of want you to treat me naughty with that naughty, that naughty little accent.
Why do you love the, like, all Americans, like, love the royal family?
Oh, I can't fucking understand that one. I remember being in college, right, and there was this one guy, and all the girls were like, and I'm not saying I was hyper attenuated to it at that time, but I could tell more or less where on the British or Irish islands you are from.
Yeah.
More or less. Sometimes, if it's particularly distinctive, I could tell from the actual city, right?
Yeah.
Can I emulate any of them? Absolutely not. I cannot do it.
Do you do that thing where you sort of like, you try and casually go, so whereabouts in England are you from? And sort of look a bit smug that you'd like
specify. No, I usually don't, because I usually already know well enough that I'm not even going to try to bother, because like, it'll come out organically.
Right.
But I remember like being in college, and there's this guy, and he is just like, he was mediocre. He weren't no Chris Webster, if you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And like, all the girls are like, oh my God, his accent is so sexy. He sounds so educated. I'm like, I'm pretty sure he's from Liverpool. So I'd watch the rims on your Toyota Camry, and I'd watch your wallet on the way out the door.
That's a terrible stereotype. And my family are from Liverpool.
Yeah.
So
well, you know, all of my Scouse friends are like, I'm like, where you get that TV? He's like, don't worry about it. I'm like, how do you have a country home in Spain? He's like, don't worry about it. I'm like, are you playing this up, or are Scouts actually like that? And he's like, don't worry about it. I'm like,
is this going to transfer in any way to your audience? Are they going to know what
Scouser
is?
Yes, we actually have a pretty good listenership in Britain Australia and Singapore,
right, cool.
And then an enormous listening in Wroclaw, Poland. I don't know why, but hello, Wroclaw, Poland.
Yeah.
No, we have a fairly cosmopolitan listenership because we have conducted interviews in Indonesia and Singapore and Malaysia and like 15 states, and a lot of guests have been English, Irish, Scottish, Australian. So here, we're all over the place.
So, well, let me turn it around on you.
Oh, shit, I'm not prepared for this, but let's go.
You asked me what it felt like to get that phone call of at least sort of temporarily kind of like, hey, you know, you're doing this, like, you're actually doing this. Well, how does it feel to, you know, it's not easy to run a successful podcast, to become a successful podcast. So like, what do you like, was there a moment for you where you were like, hey, I'm doing this, and this is actually something that's...
Chris, that was this morning.
Really?
This morning,
I
interviewed Alex Trebek for my podcast, and that was my, this is happening? Is this, because there's two, there's, is this happening? To, this is happening? To, there's three, actually. It's, is this happening? To, this is happening? To, this is happening? Like, because the first one is like, is this the real life? Did I actually do that? To, yes, I did. To, wow, that's really weird. I did do that. So this morning was, I interviewed Alex Trebek for my podcast, and we had an absolutely amazing conversation because we did not talk about health, and we did not talk about Jeopardy, because all of those things are on the record. Mm-hmm. If you want to know that, you can read it and see countless interviews. Instead, we sat down and we talked man to man about his love of home improvement, wrecking out walls, building bathrooms, fixing leaks, and then we talked about his love of Yorkshire of all places, and the Moors and the Brontes and stuff like that. And his, it was in his home. His wife came and greeted us and everything, and then got a good handshake. We talked cars a little bit in the driveway, and then took off. And I'm like, did this happen? This happened. And obviously, at time of this taping, since this just literally happened this morning, this has not yet aired. But that might be my table read right there, because I did it. I got the table read done. I winged it. It felt good. I was really gracious and happy to be there. Now, when this goes to air, that's when we find out, like you said, there's a big budget behind this, but does anyone like it? Will it go anywhere? Will it change my podcast from being the little, like, humble one it is right now to a bigger one? Do I get a corporate sponsor out of this? Do I get a bigger corporate sponsor out of this? Do I get full-time production staff? Does the production rate, or do I still keep it intimate? Because this is what I like. This is my craft, which...
Well, you're very good at it.
Well, it's not what, thank you, but it's not something I... This was something that we dreamed up, my producers and I dreamed up with, to bide our time between filming television pilots.
I just feel like I owe it to your audience to tell them that, like, having a conversation with you, like, is... Austin has a very sort of hypnotic quality to, like, you, we actually are having a proper
conversation. We are. And that's why this is why I like doing this in person like this, because I've done a couple over the phone. It doesn't work because it just rings hollow and doesn't feel hollow, because we're not actually engaging with one another and looking into his piercing blue beautiful eyes.
we've had a lot of eye contact.
I know, we've had a lot of eye contact.
I tell you for one thing, just because we've talked about it, I'm not going to stop.
I think it's fine. as I look to the top left, what was it like? If you look in the top right, it's your line. You look in the top left, you're recalling. Look bottom right, you just stole something. No, I don't know what they are. I don't think they actually are real things, or maybe they are. I don't know, whatever. So this was my table read, so now I have to go put it out there and see if it works. But this is my craft, my art, and I fell into this.
So I'm your underwhelming flight home then.
No, this is, and that's the other thing. Some of the least expected interviews I've done have been the ones that have been, one, the most well received, and two, the ones I've liked the most, where I'd be like, okay, yeah, I'm just gonna go through the motions with this person who does this weird, obscure career, and 5 minutes into it, I'm like, this is the most fascinating human being. And you actually fall into that category, because I'm like, California actor, here it comes. And
I think Mercury is in retro.
Is that what
you're saying? Pretty much. You are definitely... Oh, I have not aired Ollie's yet. So everyone is going to be in for a surprise, and Ollie might get fired. Actually, no, he's got a new job now, so he can't get fired from that one, I don't think. We will...
Did he ever tell you he denies that he did this. Do you know the story about how he fell asleep during a job interview?
No.
No, you know, he fell... So, he, you know, he's been in recruitment, and so, like, he told me once that he got let off because... he was supposed to be interviewing this, like, guy for the new CEO position, and he'd been out the night before, and he said, I was just resting my eyes, Chris. He just fell asleep during the interview, and the bloke came out fucking fuming, as you would be, and was like, who's this geezer? Why is he 23 and why is he asleep? Like, I demand someone else to interview me. I don't care if you think this is like, yeah, and Ollie got let off. And I cried when I...
All right, hold on.
I can't hear my headphones, by the way. I hope that's not...
Is that better?
Yeah.
You're better there?
Yeah.
Now it's better?
Yes. Yeah,
okay. Hold on. I'm going to put a clap here so I remember to edit that Ollie part out. Stop. Jesus Christ. Shut up. But yeah, I sort of fell into this podcast thing because, like you, I had a rejection. I have a pilot sitting on the shelf right now, filmed with a major cable television network. Huh. Hundreds of thousands, maybe a couple hundred thousand dollars were spent. We filmed it entire 14-hour day. three reality style, but three cameras, a DP, an assistant director, a director, several producers.
How long is it?
We filmed it over
30 minutes.
Yeah.
It's been a long day.
Yeah, it was a long day. It was a very long day because it was about automobiles because I'm a car nut. Mm-hmm. So we ended up having to drive different cars around in different permutations and different shapes and forms. Like the car's got to come around this corner, and the car's got to come around that corner, and the car's got to come out of this garage and into that barn and this and that and blah 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 blah. And so it was a lot of stuff to do. I loved it. I had no idea. It was just sort of something I sort of tripped into, and I fucking loved it. And there it is. And I only saw like a preliminary cut of the pilot, and then apparently they recut it and made it even better. One of my producers was like, I have never seen a first run pilot cut that well. How can this not sell? And it's out there. It's just sitting out there. People have gone. People have passed. People have maybe'd. Some people haven't seen it yet. And that's my, like, that's my albatross. No, albatrosses were bad things. That's my Maltese. No, Maltese Falcon was a dumb thing. But that's my, I don't know, what's the thing that you just keep doing? Dragon? No, that's heroin.
Well, I know what you mean, though. Sort of like that's the dragon you want to slay.
Yeah, that's, you're right. That's the one that I'm like,
on the back kind of.
I'm like, come on, man, it's made. Why can't you guys just go out there and sell it? Oh, just sell it. Right. And even if it runs like 5 episodes and get canceled, I'm cool with that.
I mean, you do that thing as well. I mean, like where everyone's just like, it's the golden age of television right now. You know, yeah, there's so much content being created.
I don't know how you watch it.
If there's all this buying going on, then like,
make it.
Yeah.
Or conversely, who's going to watch it?
Yeah.
Or then there's the tertiary is like, who cares who watches it? Just make it and someone will buy ads for it. It doesn't matter. Maybe.
You can always tell that. Yeah. If that's been the intent behind something, I think you can always tell.
You can always tell if it's a cheap cash grab. Well,
I like cars, by the way. Sorry, I should tell you. I have a 67 Mustang. Did Mackenzie tell you that?
She did.
Yeah.
I have a 89 Honda Civic Station Wagon.
Very nice.
That's my dream car. I also have a BMW 7 Series, but that's... And I also rented a Tesla while I'm doing this.
Very nice.
Yeah, no, it's
I quite like Tesla.
It's okay. It's okay. It's really competent. It's really good. And it's really comforting how amazingly car-like it is.
Right.
Without... There's no non-car aspect of it. Everyone's like, it's driving the future. I'm like, no, it's driving a natural linear progression of the automotive sort of mindset.
Yes.
In that it's a personal vehicle and it goes a very nice long distance and it's easy to operate and it's got modern conveniences. But it wasn't like, this is the future.
Yeah.
I'm just like, oh, it's a really good car.
Yeah, I was struck. I've only been inside one like once, but my friend has one, and she pulled up, and I got inside, and I just was just like struck by the kind of the lines,
yeah,
and the glass, you know, and the big screen.
Yeah.
And it was just like, oh, this is kind of cool, and the curves or whatever. Like,
yeah, it's cool.
It's cool.
It's cool. But it's not a. I mean, it's a revolution in that it's an evolution because now I. By being so decidedly car-like, because it is a car, but being so decidedly without histrionics and fanfare, it gives me hope for the mainstream acceptance of the electric car. And then that means we get to keep our super cool cars for the weekend and take them out because everyone else can do electric during the day, during the blah, 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 blah. And then we could collect a nice, cool collection of petrol cars and have them gas guzzlers and have them on a weekend without feeling bad. Because, I went for a joyride in the Tesla and I'm like, I don't feel bad. But if I go for a joyride in my BMW, which gets the greatest of 16.9 miles per gallon, right? Mm-hmm. I feel sort of guilty, like just going up and like driving up the Hudson River just for fun, because I'm like, I just watch, I'm like, I'm just burning gas. But going for a joyride in the Tesla, I'm like, I'm just taking the battery down and I'll just charge it later.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, we have grossly overstayed our welcome and gone very long, which is fine because we'll just You know what? If you're still listening, I love you. And if you're not, whatever. I think we're going to be seeing a lot of Mr. Chris Webber. Oh my. We've been talking for so long. I'm thinking he's a former Formula One driver. Right? Wasn't Chris Webber a Formula One driver?
Yeah. He was a Formula One driver.
Yeah. The incredibly talented and surprisingly heartfelt and very introspective, and I have a feeling immensely successful to be actor, Chris Webster. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Austin.
This has been A Lot to Learn with Austin Rogers. I am Austin Rogers. A Lot to Learn has been produced by myself, Austin Rogers, alongside Maria Gibson and Limitless Media. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe to it on patreon.com/AustinRogers. You can follow me on the Instagram at Agra27, on the Twitter at Austin Tylero. You could donate money, and you can find me at the Gaff West in Wayland, bartending and hosting trivia and all that kind of good stuff. I really appreciate everyone listening to me. Sorry I took a couple weeks of a break, but we're back into the swing of things. And if you got any suggestions for new episodes, hit me up on Twitter or Instagram. I'm looking forward to it. Have a great day. Bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.